The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expert advice to keep the whole family healthy at All Care, the largest Irish-owned pharmacy brand.
There you are. Good afternoon on this Friday afternoon. If you want to contact the programme, 51551 ray@rte.ie. We have a busy one for you today. A Galway woman will make history on the 9th of February when she becomes the first woman ever to conduct at the Oscars. And we'll be meeting her. Her name is Eimear Noone. Looking forward to that. It's surprising they didn't change the Oscars around, seeing as it's the day after the general election and people be following the vote. I'm joking. But I mentioned this at the very beginning when he called the election. Dancing with the Stars will be changed. It's going to be on the Saturday of the 8th and not on the Sunday of the 9th, because, of course, people will be interested to find out the result of the general election. Which brings us nicely on to our guest today on Soundtrack, Brian Redmond, judge extraordinaire and known as Mr. Nasty from Dancing with the Stars, will be with us to guide us through the soundtrack to his life, or sashay his way through the soundtrack to his life. We also got James Kavanagh and Mary Byrne to have a look at the Goop Lab. Now, people who are into this sort of thing will know what Goop is. I suppose it's the creation of Gwyneth Paltrow, and it's all about wellness and nothing to do with making money now. It's just about sharing her thoughts on life and her products with people in order to make the world a better place. And it's called Goop. And now there's a Netflix 6-part documentary where she goes through various things that can improve your life over 6, you know, episodes. And it landed, dropped, whatever the word is, on Netflix this morning. So we said, get up early, Mary Byrne. Get up early, James Kavanagh. Look at that and come in and talk to us about it. Patrick Frayne is writing about it today in the Irish Times. Very funny. He's a very funny man. So that's a sort of a review of the Goop Lab. After 4 o'clock, we've music from Shebale Nikasada, that amazing singer. And she's going to sing 2 tunes for us. Now, listen to the news. And is it just me? Or is it just me? Or do you go somewhere down in Cork and Sultans of Ping FC when they say manifesto? You do. Yeah, you do.
What do you think about my manifesto? I like a manifesto. Put it to the test. Talk a bit down.
You see, that's where you go when you hear manifesto. Got a manifesto, put it to the test. Which is strangely connected to something that happened in our kitchen at home this morning. So picture this. I'm tucking into my porridge. And Jenny's going, what's that song? Jenny's going, what's that song? It's something about classic, writing a classic or something like that. And I go, you're not talking about Adrian Gurvitz's classic. That's the name of the song. I don't know if it was a classic. With one of the cheesiest rhyming couplets of all time. That's what I said to her. That's the way I talk at that hour of the morning. That's what porridge does to you. And then I sang it for her, which I won't subject you to. I'll just play the original.
Gotta write a classic. Gotta write it in an attic.
Cheesiest rhyming couplet of all time. And then I got me thinking about other rhyming couplets. Like Desiree. She says, I don't want to see a ghost. It's a sight that I fear most. I'd rather have a piece of toast and watch the evening news. You think I'm making that up?
I don't want to see a ghost. It's a sight that I fear most. I'd rather have a piece of toast, watch the evening news.
There you go. Wasn't it Sting who said that he bought a book of rhymes before he wrote Every Breath I Take? Some of them are just silly, some of them were cheesy, and some of them were a little bit nasty. Like, how could anybody think that this was a good line to put in a song?
I'm serious as cancer when I say rhythm is a dancer.
I'm serious as cancer when I say rhythm is a dancer. And of course, then that brings you nicely on to,
what do you think about my manifesto? I like a manifesto, put it to the test. Talk a bit down to me.
There you go. Cheesy rhyming couplets. And you're saying, Ray, you have to play that song in its entirety. I know you're saying that. You're shouting at the radio. 51551, ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon. And where's me jumper? There's a song that, when translated into Irish, actually works. Cawil McGansey, Cawil McGansey. I know this because we did it back in the den all those years ago. Great memories, says Colin. And Connor is enjoying that as well. And that'll be in my head all day. Thanks, maybe. Exclamation marks, as somebody. And when you ask Brian Redmond when he's in, would he do the show next year, as in be a competitor rather than a judge? That's a very good question. I'll ask him that question. Very good question. Yesterday we asked the question about driving, and we were wondering, were there people out there of a certain age who couldn't drive and had promised themselves that 2020 would be their year where they would get behind the wheel and learn how to drive? And we put out the call yesterday, and Shane answered our call, and so too did Aisling. And Niamh upstairs has been on to Shane and Aisling, and they've said that if they can make space in their very busy diaries, that they'll come in and talk to us about the fact that they can't drive and that they're planning to learn how to drive. These people are in their 30s and 40s. We're not talking about somebody who's 18 or whatever. Ray, try O'Carroll by Neil Sedaka for a cheesy rhyme. O'Carroll, I am but a fool. Darling, I love you, though you treat me cruel. You hurt me and you made me cry, but if you leave me, I will surely die. Yeah, it's cheesy enough. Cheesy enough. There are cheesier out there, though. There are cheesier out there. I'm going to write a classic, and I'm going to write it in an attic. Now, it's hard to beat that one. I remember going to discos in the early 80s. Everyone would just pile jackets and jumpers into a handy corner, some crack trying to find the jumper at the end of the night. And they'd all be shouting, "Where's me jumper? Where's me jumper?" 51551, ray at rte.ie.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Oh, Eimear Noone is with me in Studio 10, and she has brought with her the baton that she will use to conduct the orchestra, who will be performing the best original score nominations at this year's Oscars. By doing that, Eimear Noone from County Galway will be making history. Explain that to me.
Oh my God, when you put it like that.
But you are making history. You are making Oscar history.
Well, it will be the first time that a woman has ascended the podium in front of the orchestra at the Oscars.
Congratulations!
Thanks, Ray.
This is such a big deal that we're on Instagram with this chat, just in case people want to have a look at you.
Oh my God, great. That's all I need. Yeah.
This is huge news. Like, obviously huge news for you, but I find it shocking again that there hasn't been a woman as a conductor at the Oscars ever before.
Well, you know, it's great this year. There's two fantastic women producers, and they're the types that they're having their moment in the sun. So they're doing something for their industry that's a positive, and they're reaching down and pulling the rest of us up, yeah. You know?
It is a male-dominated profession.
Well, you know what? We're doing our best to slightly alter that. And
What would the ratio be? Men to women in conducting.
There isn't even any data yet.
Oh, is there not?
Not really, no.
Yeah.
But I will say people like our own National Concert Hall have a program at the moment that I'm participating in, but I'm very jealous of because it wasn't there when I was a student. But it's a program for women conductors, the female conductors program. So you have people like that, and people like the National Symphony Orchestra as well, you know, doing something to balance a little bit, because we are 50% of the population.
Yes, you are. And actually, there are more women in Ireland than men.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Fractionally. So tell us a bit about yourself. Where in Galway are you from?
I'm from East Galway. I'm from a village called Kilconnell.
Where is that close to now?
It's a very rarefied air, a very, very competitive area, because we have Aucrum 3 miles one way, and right. That's where Oscar winner Danny Boyle's family is from, and they did have a pretty well-known battle there at one point, yes, as well. And the other side is Ahaskra, which is the home of the Baal Sean Moncrief, and of course the greatest milliner the world has ever known, which is Philip Tracy. So yeah. We have a composer, the great Paddy Fahey from Kilconnell.
Tell
so
me
I'm,
about
I'm
Paddy
trying to keep
Fahey.
Up. Paddy, we sadly lost Paddy in the last couple of years, but he, for over 100 years, graced our planet writing wonderful, wonderful traditional Irish music. And some of the most interesting pieces of identifiable melody that are out there came from Paddy's pen, right. You know.
And what's the population of Kilconnell?
It's about 580, I think.
Right. When did you know about the fact that you were going to be performing at the Oscars and making history?
Just before Christmas.
Right.
Yeah.
Who did you tell?
Of course, first person, Mammy.
Yeah.
I told my mom first, and then my brothers and my best friend.
And
so that was
a
it.
Lot
That's
of these things
told.
Have to be kept secret, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah.
How did that go for you?
Well, semi-well, because, I think everyone in Kilconnell knew well ahead of the world press. But, you do need to make sure that things are rolled out in a way that the Oscar producers envision that serves what they want to do. And also there's a sort of element of disbelief,
you know? On your part?
I needed to see the press release myself, you know.
Okay. So you've been pinching yourself since before Christmas.
Where
did it all start for you? So obviously, is Kilconnell a sort of a musical hotbed, or was your family musical?
My grandfather was a traditional musician at a time when really you couldn't really earn money from being a trad musician. So he had another profession. But I was surrounded by lots of great trad. The Slopes of Ockram was Paddy Fahey's band. And but for me, seeing the orchestra for the first time at about 7 on telly, literally on RTE, I saw someone conducting an orchestra and went, right, that's what I'm going to do.
As in conducting?
Yes.
Right.
And composing, yeah. So it's sort of, it's addictive when you're inside the music, like it's a three-dimensional experience. You're looking at the score and you can see the notes on the page, but when you're on the podium, you're inside of all of that. It's happening around you. And
Can you see music then?
Clearly I can read it, you know, there are certain things. There's. I'll hear orchestration and color, definitely combinations of instruments and things like that, which is, I think, it's probably fairly common among musicians.
So it's not synesthesia, you know.
It's not synesthesia, but I will definitely say, if we're at the moment, where my husband Craig and I are scoring a brilliant Irish animated feature by Irish producer Mo Honan and Motion Films, and when we see a particular colour on the screen, we'll endeavour to recreate that orally and sonically with the instrumentation. So,
what a lovely job!
if you saw us, like, you know, stuck at computers for 12 hours a day, around the clock every day, in an absolute mayhem, trying to reach the deadline, you might think otherwise.
So you studied music at college?
I did, yeah.
And like film scoring was something that you were into from early on.
Yes.
So what did you do in the National Concert Hall yourself and a mate of yours from college?
Yeah, a classmate of mine in Trinity, Gillian Saunders is her name. We decided there were certain scores that we loved so much we wanted to perform them. We wanted to hear them live. We wanted to learn the scores. We wanted to be in the middle of it. So we went about setting up an orchestra, and it's funny because now I'm about to do some recording, and a lot of that original orchestra will be in the studio with me after all these swings and roundabouts of years. We put together an orchestra of all of our pals, and we rented the concert hall, not knowing what on earth we were doing. And I was running down to the post office near Trinity with a bag of coins. This is tell you when it was. Calling Los Angeles, throwing coins into the phone box to try and get my hands on the music for Braveheart or the music for Batman or whatever we were doing. And we decided as well, we'd program great classical music that's used in film. And we felt that, you know, our moms and dads who weren't musicians could get into the music through the film music and really appreciate the classics as well. And it was a great way in. And it was. And we, you know, the mad vagabond Egypts that we were, you know, we sold out the concert hall a couple of times.
And did you conduct back then?
I did, yeah, I did.
What's it like conducting for the first time? Because how many people are in an orchestra? Around 50, is it?
It could be anything. Could be anything from around, you know, 16 up to 100 and Mahler liked himself to have 110, 120 people.
How many will be in the Oscars orchestra?
I think we'll have around 50 maybe, and choir maybe. I'm not 100. I can't say that for sure because that's not...
And the nature of it is, if you were a student, that, well, you said you guided your mates, but I'd imagine a lot since that a lot of the people in front of you are older than you.
Yes.
More experienced, as in they've been doing this for a lot longer than you have.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is that scary, daunting the first time?
Oh, it's absolutely horrifying.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's absolutely terrifying. And, you know, and it's, you know, oftentimes they're right. They see a young conductor and they go, oh my gosh, this person does not have a clue what they're doing. And, you know, a lot of the time they're right because it's something you really can't practice unless you have a room full of musicians with you. So you have to be okay with failing on a constant basis and just failing better. I mean, it's the definition of fail better, you know.
Conducting.
Yes, because you cannot,
you're learning on the job.
You can practice all you want by yourself, but as soon as you're...
Sorry, you brought me to somewhere now, you in front of the mirror with your baton.
Well, you know what, we do have to do a certain amount of technique on our own, but, you know, as soon as you're in that overwhelming room with, you know, 80 players with all kinds of sounds coming at you, it's such an overwhelming amount of information to process. Yeah. And you're looking at your score and you're trying to hear it in your head what you want it to sound like and matching it up. A friend of mine described it as time travel. You're thinking about what you want to see coming up.
Yeah.
You're listening to what you're doing right now, and you're also listening to what just went by and what you're going to do about it. And so you're in three sort of headspaces at once, and it's
I'd say the brains of conductors are quite interesting.
Oh God, interesting in inverted commas.
No, because you know, for example, in you know, black taxi drivers in London, they found that the area of the brain that deals with, you know, that geographical knowledge,
yes,
is bigger, because now we know that the brain is a muscle, that we don't die with the brain we're bought with. Or born with. So there's sort of neuroplasticity.
Right.
So if you're doing that sort of thing all the time, it's probably developing one part of your brain.
Well, there is a lot of research that says that music, performing, reading and performing music is the one thing, one pursuit that uses all four quadrants of the brain. Now, for conductors, we have to do a thing where we create neural pathways so we can do opposite things with the each side of the body. So you can do a smooth gesture with one side and keep time with the other side, you know, on something that's different. So we do train
do
that.
You brought in your baton.
I did.
Which snooker player famously had the same, I think it was not the local guy, Ken Doherty. He has the same cue that he had when he started off.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Is it a look thing with you, or is it...
Well,
important.
There's a few things. These are handmade for me by a lovely man called Phil Agulia in upstate New York, and they're weighted in a specific way that happens to be particular to me. So he created them. They have a little inscription on the handle that is an homage to those video game music fans that supported me early in my career.
We're going to talk about that in a moment. Yeah.
Yeah,
because that's where you've done an awful lot of music for video games.
Yes.
And you've composed and conducted.
That's right.
Yeah.
And all of it orchestral music.
Yeah.
So it's a bit mad.
See, it's a world that I haven't, you know, been in contact with, but it's huge.
It's like an alternate universe. Yeah, it is. It's amazing.
So some of the games now are bigger than Hollywood movies, aren't they?
Yes, that would be true. And, you know, it's amazing how many people they reach. And some of it's very democratic. There's no cultural barriers or even physical barriers. You know, people who are differently abled, their character can have the same abilities inside of a game.
So name a few of the ones you've worked on then.
World of Warcraft. I worked on the 25th anniversary of The Legend of Zelda, Metal Gear Solid.
Right.
I've done a few smaller ones for Sony, a few indies. A lot of performing for video games, live shows like that. A lot.
And The Legend of Zelda is inspired the baton.
Yeah, the most famous baton in the world is actually not that of Toscanini or Leonard Bernstein. It is the Wind Waker from The Legend of Zelda.
Right.
And so the little green guy that doesn't say anything, his name is Link. He's our hero who saves the princess. But he has a magical baton called the Wind Waker. So every one of my signature batons has an inscription on it in homage to the Wind Waker. And it says, "Wake the winds."
Right.
There it is.
And this is the baton you will use on the 9th of February.
Yes.
See, it is. I can just feel the weight in it now.
Yeah, it's actually skewed so that it points down.
Yeah.
It's not balanced. It's like myself. It's not perfectly balanced.
And there's a little inscription there. I'll just hold it up there. Can you guess that, Ellen? That's just for people watching at home. There you go.
Say we're live on Instagram.
Yeah. We're live on Instagram there. So if you lost that between now and the 9th of February, would that mess with your head?
I call my friend Phil and say, what's your FedEx? No, he created this signature series for me. And, you know, some of them get, but you can see this one's pretty battered off.
Yes.
It's been used a
good bit. Yeah, yeah. See, everyone thinks they can, don't they? Everyone thinks they can, you know, conduct. Do they? Do people, you know, because it's, you know, people just, it's like, you know, having the chat with you has been so informative because it's obviously a hugely involved thing. But do people say, give us a go, your baton?
Yeah, well, you know, so you can get away with a certain amount sometimes.
Oh, can you?
Do you want to try it?
No, well, look,
go on.
Like, do what? Who am I conducting? You and Ellen. Would you do me one favour?
Yes.
Would you just, because there is that thing at the start, isn't it? Do you have to do that or is that?
No.
Oh, you know,
no.
Oh, you would never do that.
No, no. I don't need a solo. You mean this?
Yes.
I think that only really happens in
movies.
In Disney movies.
Does it? it's not the real world.
Yeah, I don't need a solo. I'm going to leave that to the orchestra.
So what about dressing for the Oscars?
Yes.
That's a big deal.
It is, yes. I'm much more terrified about that aspect than, you know, the performance. It'll be fun with the, I know most of the musicians in the orchestra, it'll be fun. But yeah.
You're not going to tell us what you're wearing, are you?
Well, I'm hoping that I'm going to be wearing an Irish designer. So that someone I absolutely adore. And we do need to make sure we cross all the T's and dot the I's before I could say anything.
You're in negotiations.
Yes,
negotiations. Who will you be hoping to spot or get a selfie with at the Oscars?
Oh, all of them. It's funny. I was telling some of our friends here that, you know, people say to me, gosh, think of all the celebrities in the audience. I'm like, yeah, John Williams, Hildur Guttmann's daughter, there's the Thomas Newman and Randy Newman are both going to be there. And
they're not related, are they? Isn't it?
Oh, they are. Yeah.
They're related.
They are,
because I interviewed Randy Newman before and his family, there's a long legacy, isn't there, of music composition. Which one do you want to hear? We have clips of all the scores that are up for Oscars this year: Star Wars, 1917, Marriage Story, Little Women, and Joker. Which you can't say which is your favourite.
I can't. No. And I can't tell you which one I think is going to win.
You know which one that is, don't you?
I do.
Yeah, not because of the music, because you saw me pressing the button.
Either will do.
Right, great to hear you on the radio listening in tune. My daughter is currently doing a project for secondary school and had to choose a profession. She chose a conductor, as she loves music. She'd be so interested to hear about Emer's success and Oscar appearance. Good on you. And that's the thing as well. Oh. So her daughter will be watching you at the Oscars.
Oh, God.
You will be a role model, stroke inspiration, stroke making history.
Oh, God.
I often wondered if the conductor, for whatever reason, stopped conducting, would the orchestra be able to finish the tune themselves?
I'll tell you, every orchestra would say, absolutely yes.
And every conductor would say
absolutely no.
Congrats to her from everyone in Galway. Whopper news. And will she get to go to an after-show party? Think of who she'll meet. And again, we've established that. It's the composers that you want to meet.
Yes.
Not the Brad Pitts. Yeah. Okay, Little Women, of course, has an Irish connection as well.
Absolutely.
Because Saoirse Ronan is nominated for her fourth Oscar.
Amazing.
And over that, I can tell you, sending all the very best from Galway Traditional Orchestra. We remember with great fondness your visit to hear us play in Galway and your words of encouragement for our members. Very proud. Gulliva Aboo, says that person. So there you go. Well, listen, Emer, congratulations again, and the best of Irish luck.
Thank you very much.
We'll all be at home going, that's a wee no harm. Kilconnell, 500 inhabitants. That's great. Thank you very much. Well done.
Thanks,
congratulations.
Ray.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, every Friday, we invite somebody into Studio 10 and ask them to guide us through the soundtrack to their lives. Today's the turn of Brian Redmond. That's some moving. That's,
well,
he had to dance into position. He wasn't just happy to be sitting down like everybody else.
But that song over the last 3 years has certainly become the soundtrack to my life. Yeah. It happens everywhere I go.
Great to see you.
It's great to be in, as always. Thanks
so much for coming in, because I know you're a busy man. Some great clips as part of the soundtrack of your life. I'll tell you what we do. We'll do the soundtrack first, and then we'll talk about Dancing with the Stars at the
cool.
end.
Yeah.
Right, so we go straight back to 1977, 6th of March, born in the Rotunda to Thomas and Annette Redmond.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. Both your parents alive?
Yeah, thankfully. Yeah. Both still alive, both still well, both still keeping busy. You're never going to stop the pair of them, that's for sure.
What do you remember of your birth? I'm joking. How did your parents meet?
It was a painful experience. My parents met through dancing, surprisingly enough, or unsurprisingly enough, because going right back to my grandparents, both sets of grandparents danced socially, which would have been quite common at the time. But my dad's parents in particular really, really loved dancing and used to organise, you know, local tea dances and things like that as well. My grandfather worked in the old IGB, the Glass Bottle House in Ringsend, and was very involved in the social club out there, and himself and my grandmother, who is still alive.
What age is she?
She is 94.
Wow.
Or she's
a great age.
If she's listening, she'll kill me, because it's not something she's very open about. But then, you know, she saw me do it a couple of weeks ago, that she might make 9 and 5. I think she was afraid to say 95. Yeah. They were very heavily involved in dancing. And then my parents, before they met, were both involved in dancing.
Competitive dancing or just social?
My parents would have danced competitively, not maybe internationally, but they would have danced competitively, you know, certainly here in Ireland. And both families, so for example, my dad's brother also danced, and my mother's sister, who's recently, or since deceased, also danced as well. So both of them were dancing families.
So it's been ever present in your life?
Absolutely. We're certainly on 3 generations at least now.
Was there a time in your life where you can't remember a time when there wasn't dancing?
No, not really, because even like my very, very earliest memories, you know, when I was a very young child, I still sort of vaguely remember my mother and father being involved in dancing.
Yeah.
And at the time, you know, it's a small thing, I hadn't thought about it before, but at that sort of time, the girls' dance dresses, you know, the old come dancing days would have been the very huge big skirts on them, and they used to carry them around in these literally like huge big bags. And I sort of vaguely remember being at dance competitions with them and sort of, you know, treating those dresses like bean bags and sitting on them and stuff like that as well. So it's always been there.
Was it a given then that you were going to dance?
No, because I started, relatively speaking, quite late. I was 11 years of age before I started dancing. So I hadn't danced at all until I was 11 years of age.
Why so?
It just coincidence. You know, my parents obviously weren't dancing necessarily too much, you know, at that stage, because obviously they had a family to raise and, you know, the life to get on with. And it was only when I was 11 years of age, my brother, who's, you know, a few years younger than me, was around as well by then. And my parents had to go and visit somebody. Some friends of theirs who had danced as well. And those people were at a dancing competition because they now had children who were dancing. So we got the usual warning, myself and the brother in the car, you know, lads, we have to pop in here, be half an hour, be good, no messing around, you know, and we'd be in and out. And apparently I went in and I stood beside a pillar at the side of the dance floor for over an hour, just enthralled watching the other kids that were dancing, doing their thing. And then when we left, I said to my mum in the car, I said, how come we were never allowed to dance? And she said, well, it's not a case that you were never allowed. It was just something we didn't think you'd be interested in. So they made a very clever deal with us that we could go along to some classes, but we had to go for a month. And if after a month we didn't want to do it, then that was fine. But we couldn't decide after the first night. But from that moment onwards, I never remember ever not wanting to do it or not looking forward to the next class or the next competition as things went on. So it was great to have that support. And I think my parents were very clever about how they did that.
Okay. And before you started dancing at the age of 11, were you into sport? Or?
Yeah, I'm still into sport. I still love watching sport. I, you know, would have played a lot of football out on the road with the boys, the same as anybody else would have done. And obviously, when we had our first family home that I can remember, that was out in a place called Hunstown, which is just outside Blanchardstown. And that was the countryside. You know, I mean, you must have really lived in the countryside, living in Kildare when you were growing up.
No, I was townie.
You were in the middle of the town. Different sort of story altogether.
The ignorance of Dublin people. They don't understand this. But I was a townie. So
okay,
yeah.
A townie in Kildare, right?
Quite cosmopolitan, actually.
but Hunstown was like the countryside.
Yeah.
Because apart from our estate, you know, the next building that you came across was the Keepack factory out in Cluny. Cluny was a small little town, probably a bit like Kildare at the time. but there was nothing but farmland between us. Cluny as it exists now wasn't there. Yeah. So I remember spending time, you know, playing in the fields during the summer, the hay fields and stuff like that. It sounds very sort of like something out of a novel, but you know, we were running around robbing the hay bales and the farmers and rolling them up and making forts out of them and all that type of stuff. And trying to get a chase off the farmers and all that type of thing. So it was a very, I suppose, simple.
Sounds growing. Idyllic. It was a lovely childhood.
I did, yeah. And my parents played a huge part in that because, you know, I said on my wedding day that the biggest challenge I was going to face in my life was to live up to my parents and the relationship that I envisaged they had. I'm sure they killed one another, you know, behind closed doors here or there.
Well, you can sense those things if you're a child.
Yeah, but I never had a sense of that. They're a fabulous team and they still are to this day.
Right. There you go. There'll be a nice roast dinner on for you next
time. Sometime in April when I'm free on a Sunday to go over and see them.
Well, you have a free Sunday because of the election, don't you?
That's true, yeah.
Well, let's play some of your clips because, as I say, you have some great clips here. You're a big fan of Dustin.
Dustin, yeah. Isn't everybody?
But you weren't a child when that was.
I wouldn't, but hasn't everybody been a fan of Dustin? I'll tell you what I like about Dustin. I love the irreverence of him.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, there's a few people, there's people like Dustin and, you know, Mario Rosenstock who does it with celebrity, if you want to use that term in Ireland. And I think that everybody should be slated by Dustin at some point, and everybody should be done by Mario at some point because I think it keeps people grounded.
Okay, so what we've done for you, especially, right?
Right, okay.
This is probably your inspiration for your judging on Dancing with the Stars. But we've got a selection of Dustin roasting various celebrities.
Brilliant.
Right? From Marty Whelan to Zig and Zag to the late Gay Byrne to the late Derek Davis to Westlife.
Brilliant.
And they're all here in 45
seconds.
Well,
if ever I can't make Dancing with the Stars, we know how to get in then, don't we?
Oh, the Bell Mares are held the floor.
How are you, Marty? Looking brutal.
I know.
You're wearing your cheap suits, cheap moustache. How are you, Sienna? You can do with a hair appointment.
I can't understand your English accent. Speaking the Irish. Jeez. Big breakfast, and that was great. Don't see you on it much more, do you? Don't see you on it much more.
You're looking fierce, Chuck.
I was
promised. Did you not go to makeup now?
I was promised
you
would
not. You need
not
a trip to Lourdes.
Do not go near the canteen for the next few days. It's only a word of advice. That's
Did
all.
Did you use the toilet over there?
Yeah. How are you, Keane?
I'm very good, thank you.
You're looking a bit rough.
Thanks very much.
No, I mean it. You're actually looking very, very rough. Mark, how are you?
Crap.
You're my favourite in the band.
Nice one, nice
You're
one.
Mr. Personality. Crack a joke. Go on. Give us a joke, Mark.
I think that's great. And I think, you know, that sort of, it's a real Irish take on things.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, unfortunately, I think too many people take themselves too seriously these days.
You've a difficult line to walk as a judge on Dancing with the Stars because, you know, it's entertainment.
Yeah.
You're a professional.
Yeah.
You have your reputation to think about. So you have to be honest.
Mm.
But these people are, you know, they're not professional dancers. So you don't want to be mean. So that's the line you're walking every Sunday evening, isn't it?
For me, that line is the person themselves. And what I mean by that is that I'm quite comfortable being as critical as I want to be about what they are doing. But as soon as I ever think about using the terminology and say, you are this or you are that, that for me is a line that shouldn't be crossed because that can then feel personal.
Yeah.
You know, whereas I'm sure they feel it's personal at times and it's never meant that way. But that for me is the line in the sand.
Okay.
You know, the day I do that is the day I realise that I've gone too far and I'll have to apologise to somebody.
So you started dancing at 11 and you never looked back.
Mm.
What was it like in your teenage years? Ballroom dancing.
It was
because it was far from cool, I would imagine.
Probably. I never knew that. I mean, you know, I went to primary school out in Hunstown, but then I went to my secondary school, you know, made it even tougher because it was O'Connell CBS on the North Circular Road. So, I mean, I was in North Inner City Dublin and grew up in the shadow, went to school in the shadow of Crow Park. But I played sport as well. But I actually think, you know, I never experienced or never believe I experienced what people would call bullying. I certainly never felt it that way. I certainly remember slagging. I remember enjoying it. I never put too much emphasis on it. But I actually credit that to what it was I was doing in the first place. Because I'd like to think now that being involved in dance and doing what I was doing gave me such a level of self-confidence that it didn't really ever affect me. Now, not everybody is lucky enough to be that way. So I certainly don't condone, you know,
Yeah, it's interesting to say that because people say if you're very good at one thing in your life.
Yeah.
That confidence you gained from that seeps into the rest of your life.
Yeah, and, you know, that's why I've never been afraid to give things a go. Because, you know, obviously when I started off, that's what I was doing. I wasn't good when I started, but I was prepared to give it a go. And, you know, work ethic is something that's really, really important to me. It doesn't matter what you're doing in life, what you want to do in life, what you aspire to do in life. You have to have a work ethic because, you know, somebody who works hard will always beat somebody who's got talent that doesn't work hard.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Football, so we play a bit of this. Tell us about where you were at the time. So you were 14.
Yeah, I would have been 14 in 1990, which was when that track actually came out. It was the anthem for Italian 90.
Yeah.
But I think the genesis for that particular piece of music was the success that we'd had in 1988, you know, at Euro 88. And the reason I picked that track is twofold. One, because I love football, love sport, and big Man United fan. And I certainly remember that being a huge part of my normal childhood, as it were. I remember, you know, the T-shirts that everybody was getting printed and wearing around the place. And it just seemed to roll on and on and on. I remember having a barbecue at the house. That sounds very fancy. It was probably a couple of sausages on the grill before in the back garden. You know? But I remember my parents having a bit of a party for one of the games, and of course then Ireland qualified to the next round, so it was like see us all next week type thing. But that particular Euro 88, the Ireland-England match was the 12th of June, which was the Sunday. And our national championships in ballroom dancing always happened that first weekend of June. So we were down in Mosny, at the camp down there for the All-Ireland Championships. And it was my first All-Ireland Championships. And it was a two-day event, Saturday and Sunday. And the Saturday, the ballroom was really, really busy. Lots of competitions going on. And I thought it was brilliant. Just remember the atmosphere of the ballroom. But the atmosphere wasn't as good in the ballroom on Sunday, because it was half empty because everybody was in Dan Lowry's bar watching the football match, you know. And I remember actually standing on the dance floor getting ready for one of the rounds of the competition and just hearing this cheering. And it was like a parade came out of the doors of Dan Lowry's bar, walked across the little road and into the ballroom down in Mosny. So that particular track in that particular time is not just a memory because of, you know, the things that everybody else experienced. Yeah. It was my first national championships as well.
Who put the ball in the England net?
Yeah, there you go.
Ray Houghton.
Ray Houghton.
So your teenage years, ballroom dancing, did it take over?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it. Yeah, it probably did.
Did it? Really?
Yeah, it probably did. I was going to say I wouldn't say it did because I never felt like I was missing out on other things. I think at all times, my level of involvement in dancing was sort of a subconscious but yet self-driven decision by me. So I was never pushed into doing more. I never felt like I was doing more than I wanted to do, but I was doing quite a lot.
Yeah.
So the teenage years, you know, it would have been getting on the bus in the morning, going into school in O'Connell's in the North Circular Road, and then two evenings a week and probably Saturdays, I would have finished up in O'Connell's, walked down to the city centre over to, you know, the old Virgin Megastore in the Keys, and the dance school that I was going to was in Rathmines. So it would have been on the bus there, out to Rathmines, do your homework at the studio, have a bite of extra lunch, which we'd have brought with you on those days. Or, you know, my actual dance teacher's parents used to live around the corner, and they were very helpful and very kind to me for years as well, because they used to let me stop off at the house, do my homework in the front room, and the mother would make us a bit of dinner, and then we'd nip around the corner to the studio and practice for the evening.
So it wasn't easy for you. You had to go out of your way.
Yeah. Always did, yeah, but that goes back to the work ethic thing.
Yeah.
You know?
And at what stage then in your teenage years did you decide that you might want to do this full time?
I was 13.
Were you?
Yeah, and
had you ever seen somebody who was making a living out of dancing?
No. The only thing that I knew at that time was that, if you like, the generation that was a little bit older than me had all disappeared. And what I mean by that was I loved watching them at competitions here in Ireland. You know, as kids, the real treat was we used to dance during the day. Which would have been anybody under the age of 16 was on the daytime schedule. But the adults, the 16, the youth age groups, they were all in the evening. And if you had a really good day, or maybe as a little treat, your parents might let you stay into the evening to watch these older guys, you know, the more experienced ones. And I remember this generation sort of disappearing off. They were gone all of a sudden. And I learned that they'd all, not all, but a lot of them had moved to London. to access greater coaching and greater opportunities. So I decided, not knowing what this London thing really was, but I decided at 13 that that's what I was going to do. And sitting on the bus, I said to my man one day, you know, when I finish school, I'm moving to London. And as most parents would to a 13-year-old, it was like, no problem. So it was never an issue.
But you did.
But I did. And when I got old enough, I was a little bit younger than I should have been. I actually got my first job in McDonald's at 15 years of age, or pretended I was 16. But we won't go into that anyway. I started working in McDonald's. And worked in McDonald's on O'Connell Street because, again, it was handy. I could go into school, a couple of evenings a week in McDonald's, a couple of evenings a week training. And I saved up. And by the time I was finished my leaving cert in the September of that year, I had about £500 saved up.
Right.
And nipped across the Virgin Megastore across the road because Use It, the student travel group, was in there. Couldn't book flights online at that stage. And I booked a flight to London. I think it was the 17th of September. And we used to get a weekly dance publication would come in, an old classified newspaper thing from the UK called Dance News, and sat down one day and opened up the back of it and saw the listings for apartments and shared rooms and shared, and just literally made a phone call. And it was an Australian guy, a guy called Paul Houston, who had a house in London near where all the dance studios were. And he had a spare bed in one of the rooms sharing with an Australian lad. So I said, all right, I'll be over in the middle of September. And went home to mum and dad and said, I booked that flight. I was like, which flight? Remember I told you years ago I was going to move to London. Well, I have it sorted. I'm going. And 17th of September, jumped on the flight and went off to London.
£500 in your back pocket.
Not for long, though.
Why not?
Well, because, you know, I'm sounding really old when I'm saying this. Because of the fact I had this little Filofax thing. Do you remember the old Filofaxes?
Yeah.
I got one for as a leaving present. So I could write down everybody's phone numbers in them, you know. And I had the address of where I was going to stay in London, and arrived into Heathrow Airport and thought, right, well, how am I going to get there? You couldn't Google Maps it, you know. So I thought, just taxis over there, I'll jump in one of them. Got into a black taxi of all things. And by the time I arrived at the place where I was staying, my £500 was £400.
£100 for a taxi?
Yeah, I'm sure I got ripped off. I'm sure it wouldn't cost you £100 now, but I certainly learned fairly quickly. So. Well,
you'd probably get the bus or the train, if it had any sense.
Yeah, but I had loads of money, right? I had £500 in my back pocket and I was 17 years
and
of age.
You have no stories of you know, hedonism or drug dens or orgies or anything like that?
All of it, yeah. But my mum's probably listening, so I'm not going to go into too much detail. But it was a great time. It was certainly a learning curve because, you know, at 17 years of age, to people listening at home, to parents, and even as a parent myself, you know, 17 seems so young.
Yeah.
But I think I was equipped for it. You know, I was certainly equipped.
And what happens then? You get a partner, do you?
Yeah, so I moved over to London. I'd only ever danced with one girl here in Ireland, and I suppose for a couple of reasons. I suppose I had a feeling, rightly or wrongly, that maybe I needed to move to the next stage of my career and that needed to be a clean start in that sort of circumstance. So after dancing with Denise for the 6 or 7 years that I'd been living here.
You ditched her.
Ditched her. Yeah, no, see, I was cruel from the start, really. But I moved over to London, and as I arrived at the house that day and knew where all the studios, I knew the addresses of the studios, which were all around that sort of area. And there was an old studio called Semley, which was just the area. It was just named after the area that it was in. It was quite nearby. So literally dropped the bags and ran straight.
Can you explain to me how you made money, though?
Oh, well, to start with, it was like any job in actor, and not a job in actor. We weren't funded. We'd no funding, you know. It wasn't like, you
so
know,
what would you be paid
people.
For? Would you be paid?
Well, at that stage, nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing.
And if you won a competition, was there
no,
money there?
Because
no,
because technically we were a bit like the golfers, I suppose. At that stage,
you were
still classified as amateurs.
Right.
So we couldn't win prize money. We couldn't, you know, do paid shows or anything like that. We literally had to support ourselves. So my first job that I got was in a sandwich bar.
All right.
And over the 7 or 8 years that I was in London permanently, it was sort of any job that I could bluff through long enough to keep
for
myself.
Your love of music, for your love of dancing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was working during the day and then dancing and training in the evenings, the weekends.
Right. We have this song. And what was the measure of being famous in your world? What was the dream?
It was a weird thing because it wasn't about being famous. It's apt now, I suppose, playing that. But I mean, the reason I picked that track, it was the first time, it sort of harps back to the days, probably just before I left Ireland, when I was starting to go abroad and starting to travel and going up to Belfast, representing the Republic of Ireland or the South of Ireland in competitions and events up there. And Bross were a huge band at the time. And I was into Bross because everybody else was into Bross. And, you know, I don't know whether you remember, I'm sure you do, they used to wear badges on their jeans and ripped jeans. And And one of the things they used to do was on the shoes, they used to wear what they called bottle tops.
Right.
They were the little metal clips that you could get for resealing the top of a bottle.
Oh, the Grolsch.
The Grolsch. Well, yes, yeah, Grolsch beer bottles had them. But you couldn't get those bottle tops anywhere down here. But they sold Grolsch up in Belfast. Okay. So when we'd go to the comps as young kids and teenagers, we certainly weren't of drinking age, but we used to go around and nick all the bottle tops off the bottles
of boots.
Beer. For our boots and everybody else's boots in school, you know. But the interesting thing about being famous is it was never something I wanted to be. And to this day, it's
no,
something...
No, but I get away from the fame thing. But what I suppose my question is, what was a measure of success in your world? Like, where were you aiming for?
I don't know. To be as good as I could be.
All right. And whatever came with that. Side effects.
You know, so for me, it was never about being number one. I'm extremely competitive, but I channeled that competitiveness into myself, into pushing myself, into trying to drive myself. Yeah. And I always liked to feel I was very aware of, if you like, my circumstance. You know, one of the things that I remember a guy that was a few years older than me that I looked up to quite a lot, that was, you know, pushing to make the world's final at the time. And for many, many years, he pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed and couldn't quite get there until one particular weekend, there was a clash of two big events on at the same time. And half the field went to one event, half the field went to the other. And he all of a sudden made this big final. And he hung around for another 3 or 4 years afterwards. And by the time he turned professional or retired, if you like, he'd actually dropped back a couple of rounds. I thought, I'm never going to do that. And I always felt that my success, as in how well I placed in the competition, wasn't going to be just based on how hard I worked, because it was always going to be balanced by the talent that I had or didn't have and the things that I had at my disposal.
Yeah.
So having to work to fund myself was going to limit me in certain ways.
Yeah, so what you could do, yeah.
When I reached the point that I felt like, do you know what? I'm happy with my lot, happy with what I've done. I was also starting to travel a lot more for teaching and things like that.
And that's a paid job.
That's a paid job.
Now, listen, we've text there and we have a break to take. So we'll take the break and then we'll chat to you more after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Brian Redmond is guiding us through the soundtrack to his life. Noel and Anne Nolan.
Oh, yeah.
Say hello to Brian.
We
think he's a super judge and very honest. He tells us it exactly as it is. We know him and his parents for years. Lovely people. Ask him who will win. I think it's going to be Mary Kennedy. Is that person?
I'm not quite sure about Mary. I think, you know, I think she'll do very, very well. I think she's going to be around for a number of weeks yet. I think she's going to have to up the dancing side of things a little bit, because of course we've got dance off still to come from about week 5 or 6 onwards. And if they end up in the bottom two, you know, you're going to need to be better than the person you're competing against to stay in. So that may be the stage where Mary needs to up that game a little bit to have a chance.
So you awarded your first one in 4 years
to
Father Ray last week.
I did.
You're going straight to hell. That's
right. I know. And as Father Ray holds the door to hell open, I'm sure Michael Caruth will be jumping up and down in my head to make sure I get in there as well, because he's not been too far behind him either.
Love him. Very positive guy. And tell Brian his godmother said hello. She's
Joan.
Listening.
What's your name? Joan, down in Wexford.
Joan. Right, so tomorrow, do you do rehearsals on a Saturday or is it all day Sunday?
It depends on what's going on. It's all day Sunday for sure. We do a little bit on Saturday, depending on what we've got. And we've a little, Julian and I, Lorraine, have a little cameo in the opening number for Mamma Mia. So we've got to go in a little bit earlier tomorrow.
This Sunday, yeah. Before you go, and I know you wouldn't be too comfortable doing this, but how many world championships, etc., have you won over the years?
I never won a world championship.
Right.
Too difficult. It couldn't get to that level, but I think I won 9 All-Ireland titles.
9 All-Ireland titles.
Yeah, across the different
age groups.
And
what's your favourite dance?
My individual favourite dance would be Foxtrot.
Would it?
Yeah, I love the feeling for it. It's still very powerful in its movement, but it's quite sort of relaxed and chilled out at the same sort of time as well. And I love the atmosphere of it.
And you met your wife through dance?
I did, yeah. I mean, that's another story.
Is she a dancer?
She competed up until she was about 15 or 16. She's not a professional dancer.
Do you ever dance
like
at home or in the kitchen of an evening?
I would.
And do the kids mark you with the paddles?
You just got this whole imagery thing going on, don't you? Yeah, no, I'm not that self-centred, right?
They're sitting up at the kitchen counter, you see, on the stools with their paddles.
Jen.
The two lads are sitting there with their paddles, giving you marking.
Alex, I would be quite happy to have, that's my boy, he's 10, I'd be quite happy to have him judge me because he's quite placid, but Anna now, the 5-year-old, she'd probably rip me to shreds, so I would look forward to that.
Well, listen, good luck with the rest of Dancing with the Stars. Enjoy your Sunday off that you're getting as a result of the general election, and it's a real pleasure talking to you.
And you, Brian,
thank you very much.
Thanks very much.
51551 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Now, we're joined in the studio by Siobhan Lee Cassida. How are you doing, Shabail?
Great, thank you.
Who'd you bring with you?
I have my dad, Oran Acosta, and Mike Nielsen with me.
Great.
On guitar.
And you're going to sing for us. You were singing last night as part of Tradfest. How did that go?
I was, yeah, it was brilliant. We were in the Pepper Canister Church. And yeah, we had a full house and just a great atmosphere. And it's such a nice festival. Such a lovely week for trad.
Yeah. Yeah, and everybody there wants to be there. I know that sounds a bit obvious, but, you know, it's, yeah. They're out sort of sampling what Ireland has to offer, the best of Irish music.
Absolutely. There was people there like that flew from Germany and Chicago and all over just for that concert and for more concerts this week. So.
Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
And it continues, and you can find out about all the gigs on tradfest.ie, tradfest.ie. So what are you going to sing for us first?
I'm going to sing Manon Aherne.
When you're ready. Looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Came alive.
you have to leave a moment of silence after that so people can digest it. That was glorious, beautiful.
Thank you so much.
She's brilliant to somebody. I had to stop the car. Amazing and beautiful, Vincent in Cork. And have we discussed this before? Shebale for Eurovision. Has that ever been brought up?
That's been brought up a couple of times. Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
We'll see. We'll see. I'm not sure. I mean, it would be amazing, but
yeah. So the door is open if they came a knocking.
If they came a knocking, sure. Who knows?
Yeah. Since we spoke last, you've changed what you're studying.
Yeah. So last year I was studying in UCD and I absolutely loved UCD. I was in the Irish House and everything. But I changed courses. So I moved to Galway and now I'm studying medicine. So
yeah. Yeah. Your dad's sitting beside you there and he let it slip before we went on air that you did it without consulting with your parents.
Yeah, no, and not consulting with anyone really. Yeah, I just kind of did it on a whim. And,
on a whim?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, oh God, people at home are going, oh no, such a high achiever. So what you did?
I just did, so I'd done my leaving cert and then I was studying physio and then just last year after my physiotherapy exams, I was like, okay, will I ever just try and get into medicine? So I just sat the HPAT and then came August and I got the offer. I hadn't told my parents, hadn't told anyone. And I was like, oh, okay, I'm probably going to go to Galway to my dad and my mum. They're like, to do what? And I was like, well, I just got into medicine, so to do that.
And why didn't you tell anybody? Was it fear of failure or what was it?
I don't know. I think like I am a singer as well. And also I was so happy in UCD. I think it was more like I didn't want to tell anyone unless I was definitely going to accept wanted to go.
Fair enough. Okay. Yeah. Right. You're going to stay with us and you're going to sing us another song before 4:30, which we're really looking forward to. For the moment, Shebale Gurmagat.
Gurmeel Mahat.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Email ray@rte.ie. The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, Hollywood A-lister actor Gwyneth Paltrow has become a big name in the wellness industry with her lifestyle brand Goop. She launched it in 2008. Goop has made headlines over the years for some of their wackier, expensive products that they claim will improve your life, including a $42,500 pillow made entirely of rose quartz. And most recently, a $75 candle called This Smells Like My Vagina, which sold out, just for your information. Now, Netflix have got involved and the Goop Lab with Gwyneth Paltrow is available to stream from today. Viewers are given a behind-the-scenes look at the team as they take on a number of experiments. That's in inverted commas. All in the name of wellness. That's in inverted commas too. And I should warn you that we will be discussing things of an adult nature over the next few minutes in the company of James Kavanagh and now Mary Byrne. Good afternoon to you both.
Hello, how are you?
Thank you so much.
What an entrance.
Thank you so much for getting up early this morning and watching the Goop Lab for us. Now, Mary Byrne, I'll let you get settled. So, James, I'll ask you the first question. What did you know about Gwyneth Paltrow and Goop before you watched this morning?
Do you know what? I didn't know a lot about Goop at all. And to be honest, I didn't know a whole lot about Gwyneth. I know she's like a complete worldwide celebrity, but I knew she was with Chris Martin for a while, even though they're consciously separated. Yes. I knew she had a daughter called Apple and she's kind of a new age vibe type person. But then I seen last week her candle that smells like her vagina apparently went viral and sold out. And I kind of became obsessed with her. I was like, she's a genius. Like I was on Goop then afterwards reading a couple of articles and I'm like, what am I doing? She's dragged me in with her vagina. But so I think she's brilliant and I'm a new fan of the show.
She's worth her Goop sort of industry is worth $250 million.
I know. Yes. She's either a genius or there's a lot of perverts out there.
I want the candle.
What did you know about Goop before we
absolutely
asked you to do this?
Nothing. I mean, yesterday was the first day I heard about it. All right. But then I watched the programme and I have to say I wasn't taken in. Because a lot of the stuff she was telling us I already knew and I'm sure the majority of people in the world know. I got my kick in the ass from Operation Transformation and that made me realise that
you're looking great, by the way.
Thank you very much. Yes, that's down to the lads in Operation Transformation who getting me up and getting me out going. I don't want to keep mentioning them all the time, but through them I learned an awful lot about me, mind-wise and physical-wise.
So Goop, a lot of what you knew already. But just for people who haven't watched it yet, and that'd be most people. So there are 6 episodes and each one concentrates on a type of treatment that might improve your life. For example, the first one is deals with psychedelic psychotherapy. And some of the Goop employees are sent off to Jamaica to take magic mushrooms in a controlled setting.
Yeah. Do you know what? Like, they say this is all new age and stuff, but this stuff has been going on since, you know, Native Americans and stuff like that. So I don't know if you can call it new age. But there is a disclaimer on the top of each episode that says this is not medical.
Read it. This is exactly what it says at the top of each episode.
You have to take that in.
The following series is designed to entertain and inform, not provide medical advice. You should always consult your doctor when it comes to your personal health or before you start any treatment or watch this program. No, it doesn't say that. I just had the bit at the end.
Yeah. But I would be of the you know, ask your doctor and go down the medical route first. But it is really interesting to see all this happen, and through the episodes the format is kind of the same in each one. They have a couple of Goop volunteers. They go over to Jamaica, like you said, take magic mushroom tea, and they go on this kind of journey that brings up a lot of trauma from their past, and they begin to deal with it. And then they interview kind of people for people from the public who've done this and who have great stories to back it up. So it's interesting to see that other way of looking at life.
You said, can I quote you, or were you
quote me? Yeah,
go on. You said that you
I'd be mad now to do mushrooms, but I'd want to do it in that controlled setting. I've never done them because I'm too scared of what might happen, but I love the idea of, like, well, professionals in inverted commas surrounding you and minding it. Now, Mary's giving me evils here. I don't know if you quite agree.
Evils. I mean, I would hate to have someone else have control of my mind. Yeah. I mean, I watched it, and this guy crying into the arms of two other guys. And I actually felt like crying with him.
They were qualified psychotherapists.
They were,
qualified psychedelic.
Well, whatever they were. Psychedelic or delicky-sally. I don't know. All I know is, it was, for me, a bit cringy. Because, you know, like, I don't know about anybody else, but I mean, I've had a little bit of the other stuff when I was quite young and got myself quite high and quite laughed all the way through it. And didn't like the idea that, you know, I wasn't in control. Yeah. I don't like that.
Well, I think what James was saying was that he likes the idea that you're surrounded by people who have your best interest at heart.
And charge you a fortune. You could do that at home with your best friends.
That's very true, yeah. I do like the idea of them guiding you and stuff. And you know that when in one of the scenes, she's lying on the floor looking at the clouds. And I like those bits. I don't like the scary cry bits.
I do that in any way. I do, seriously. In the summer, I lie in the back garden and look at the clouds.
The second episode, we won't get through them all, but the second, this Iceman, Wim Hof. And I've heard about him from a number of people. It's the first time I saw him. So basically it is cold showers and jumping into very cold water. Yeah. And he says that it's very good for your immune system.
It is. Yeah.
Changes the pH balance in your body.
He says a shower a day keeps the doctor away. Do you have cold showers?
I don't have cold showers, but I have dived into freezing cold water and the sensation is unbelievable. And you do feel really renewed after it. He interested me. I'd like to go and spend a couple of days with him and learn that breathing technique
and do snoga.
Feel fabulous.
Definitely. I do sea swimming and I do it in the winter as well. And
you could be out there now walking around and in the freezing cold. I'd love to.
That's a date. But I do feel after I get into the RC and out, it feels like you've 10 coffees or something. Like you feel
it's
totally
beautiful
renewed.
Feeling.
So I'd be into him now. I'd be into going and seeing what he's all about.
Before we get to episode 3. Before we get to episode 3, I'm just wondering, what is your take on Gwyneth? Because I came away from it, actually, because I watched 3 episodes myself, liking her.
Me too, yeah.
Yeah.
But then I didn't like her because I felt maybe she's preying on people who are a bit vulnerable and a bit weak and separating them from their money. So I was sort of conflicted there.
Well, all those different kind of activities they were doing, they're not run by her, they're run by other people. Yes. So she's in a way presenting these things to the world and saying,
I know, but as you said at the top, you were dragged into her goopness.
Yes.
And before you know it, you'll be buying one of her candles when they're available again.
Yeah.
You wanna watch Diana? Diana wouldn't like that.
So episode 3 is The Pleasure Is Yours.
Yes, I actually enjoyed this one. It was a bit cringy at first because I was kind of going, oh God, because most of women all over the world, we're programmed to feel embarrassed about our sexual, you know,
feelings.
Yes. And I think every single woman on the earth should be allowed to find pleasure wherever they find it without feeling guilty.
Yes.
And we're always made to feel guilty. So I found this quite liberating and I would love the majority of women all over the world to look at this particular episode and to realise it's okay to enjoy pleasure.
Yes. The expert in it is a lady called Betty Dodson. She's 90
she's
years
crazy.
Old.
And she doesn't look it.
Her CV claims that she's taught 7,000 women to orgasm. That's her claim to fame.
Well, I have
years.
To say,
yeah.
Yes.
She wouldn't have to teach me now, but like, you know, I'm very happy for all the rest of them.
I loved that episode and I loved You're One the Sex Educator. It was very body positive
it
and
was.
It was all about looking at your body and learning to love it. If you're going to watch any episode, watch episode 3. I think that was a really good
one. Yeah, I think the part that kind of made me a bit cringy, and I shouldn't be because it was part of a woman, was when they showed a certain part of your anatomy. And I was kind of going... And like I have one. Yeah. But the same thing, at the same time, it was so bold.
Yeah.
For, you know, I mean, for anyone watching it, you kind of go, oh, well, then I'm okay. Like, that's the same as mine.
Yeah.
Like, because as they
it's
were saying,
real.
That a lot of people, because of porn movies and stuff like that, a lot of young men seem to think women's vagina, if I can use that word, is pink and beautiful.
Yes.
It's not.
Yeah.
It's very natural and, you know, not particularly a nice place if they don't like it. But they are enhanced in certain ways, these women, apparently through, you know, operations. And
it's interesting that both of you found that to be your favourite of the six.
Yeah, I
did. And he doesn't even have one.
Do you know what? I want one, though, after.
Oh,
because
God.
There's over 8,000 nerve endings, way
there
more
is.
Than a penis.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Believe
so
you me.
That just left me jealous after that episode.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. So the Goop Lab has landed or has dropped or whatever the word is used on Netflix, so it's there for everybody to see. Mary Byrne, thank you so much for coming in.
It's been a pleasure.
James Cavanagh, thank you.
Anytime.
And I'm sure we'll talk again.
I hope so.
You can turn around now because we're going to be entertained by Shebeale and Mike and Oran. What are you going to sing us out on, Shebeale?
I'm going to sing Blackbird.
Oh, lovely. Great.
Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly. All your life you were only waiting for this moment to arise. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see.
Interruption halfway through.
Sorry.
Shebeale, that was lovely. And that features on your
album yes,
which
you.
Is available to download, stream and everything else.
It is. Yeah.
And people will be seeing you at some stage throughout the year. You're concentrating on your studies, I know, for the moment.
I am, yes. I'm going to finish this semester in Galway and then do some more gigs in the summer abroad and here as well.
So. Okay. Thanks so much for coming in today. Oran, thank you. Mike, thank you. Shebeale Nicasada, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it from us. We're back on Monday. Mary Wilson's on the way. Enjoy your weekend. And we'll talk to you at 3 o'clock Monday.